The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you all for coming out tonight. It's wonderful to be back in Philadelphia. As I drove up here tonight, getting here early so as not to get stuck in traffic, I was reminded all again of the many, many Thanksgivings of my childhood spent coming up the Ben Franklin Parkway on my way to my grandmother's house on near Broad and Olney, and how each one of us, I have five brothers and sisters, we laid claim to one of the fountains along the parkway as our own. My older sister got the one dead opposite the library, the beautiful one, and I had the one with Washington on it a little further along. That's what his second child gets. I wanted tonight, this is in a certain way a kind of valedictory evening for me, because this is, as far as I know, the last time after many occasions when I'm going to be talking about this book and these two men. I have been on the road talking pretty much without cessation, or presumably without a whole lot of interest, about these two guys since sometime in January. And this is, as I say, here back in my hometown, is the last place, at least I'm scheduled for now, to talk about them some more. So what I wanted to do tonight was to sum up, if you'll allow me, to talk a little bit about what I've learned and what I think this book is about now at the end of having spoken about them, and what I think more broadly the whole enterprise of having written a book like this is about. Angels and Ages is a book about Darwin and Lincoln, and it begins with the simple and sort of startling coincidence that Darwin and Lincoln were born on the same day, February 12th, 1809, and we're celebrating the 200th anniversary of that date. We're celebrating their 200th birthdays this year. And in addition, we're celebrating the 150th anniversary on today, on this very day, of the publication of Darwin's On the Origin of Species. And since many things happened to Lincoln in 1859 as well, we could add on some 150th celebrations there as well. But their common birthday, their being born on the same day, is in many respects simply a coincidence, a cosmic coincidence perhaps, but a coincidence nonetheless. In looking at this book and becoming excited about this material and wanting to write these two lives, I didn't want to and didn't claim to draw any set of particular parallels between the two of them, to write a dual biography or to convince you in the spirit of those old classroom posters that said, you know, Lincoln's secretary was named Kennedy, Kennedy's secretary was named Lincoln, and so on, to convince you that there was some occult pattern of resemblance between these two men that other historians had missed. Not at all. What interested me, and what still interests me, is not so much what they had in common with each other, but what they have in common with us. What is it about the ideas that they fathered, about the words that they used, about the vision that they had, that still resonates, that still rings, that still is part of our world today and of our understanding of the world today? Of course, it's certainly true that they experienced, they witnessed, and helped midwife an enormous revolution in human consciousness. You can grasp that, I think, feel it intuitively, if you just think about what the world was like in 1809, when these two young boys and these two babies come into the world, one in a comfortable house, when Darwin, in England, born to wealth and comfort, the other in a backwoods cabin in Kentucky, Abraham Lincoln. What the world was like then, what men's and women's minds were like, what the mental makeup and consciousness of the world was like in 1809. Democracy, republicanism, was not seen as a beneficial, desirable arrangement of affairs. It was seen as something at best idealistic, at worst guaranteed to give way as soon as it was imposed to tyranny and anarchy. And the example of the French Revolution, which even then in 1809 was still in the course of its degeneration into Napoleonic absolutism, gave very powerful arguments for that case. democracy was seen as something that, however ideal, however appealing it might be, always came apart at the seams. And even the example of the American Republic, still so very young, seemed unconvincing. You may remember that de Tocqueville came to the United States a little bit later in the 1820s, and though we think of de Tocqueville as an admirer of America, as indeed he was also a profound skeptic of the possibility of the democratic experiment continuing to last, persisting, exactly because he saw that this new country was torn apart, had tectonic faults at its very base, most profoundly and significantly, the fault and the flaw of slavery. The science of life, was in an equally remote and to us alien condition. It was taken for granted by most educated people, including most scientists, that all the species of life that we see around us, all the countless varieties of animals and plants, had separate beginnings. They had all been created or founded at different moments in different ways, that they were all separate volumes in the great library of life, rather than being simply new pages, new chapters in one single ongoing story. Religious-minded people were inclined to think that the earth was very young, several thousand years old at most. But even among those who had already begun to accept the notion of a much older earth, the idea that there was some kind of continuous and comprehensible connection amongst all of the varieties of life was still regarded as a poetic idea, as a fancy, as a fantasy. And in fact, Charles Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus, had written a poem just on this theme of the possible evolution of forms, and it was seen by all men of science as a good poem. That was the condition of the world in 1809, when these two boys were born. And then think of the condition of the world in 1881 when Darwin dies, after Lincoln, of course, has been assassinated in 1865. When Charles Darwin finally passes away and these two men have vanished from the world, it's widely accepted throughout the entire Western world and indeed well beyond that democracy, republican government, is something that is almost certainly the wave of the future and is something that can defend itself, something that can sustain, something that can fight and survive, not break down into anarchy, not dissolve into tyranny, not be impervious to the earthquakes that pernicious social institutions like slavery create, but instead can counter those earthquakes and survive, can last. And we often forget that the Statue of Liberty, which sits in New York Harbor, is not, as we imagine it now in the rearview mirror of our history, a monument to the immigration, the great immigration that began in those days and that brought my grandparents here to Philadelphia, among many other immigrant arrivals. No, it's a gift from the new republic, the Third Republic of France in the 1870s, which has remade itself in Europe. It's a gift from one republic to another, saying that the republican movement, republics, liberty, will hang together. It's a profound transformation in consciousness. And similarly, by 1881, by the time Charles Darwin dies, although there's enormous controversy about exactly what the mechanism is that enabled the forms of life to have changed and evolved in some comprehensible way from the very first beginnings, millions and millions of years ago, into the forms we see now. While that's controversial and, in fact, won't begin to be settled until well into the 20th century when genetics are added to evolution and we have the neo-Darwinian synthesis, although the specifics are controversial, no one, no scientist, no one in a position to understand doubts any longer but that the world is very, very, very old, and that the story of life is one story. Profound, dramatic, radical changes in the way we imagine the foundations of the history of life and the possibilities of human government. Darwin and Lincoln, as I say, hardly made those changes, hardly made those transformations entirely by themselves, but as much as any two men could, they midwifed that transformation. So this book and my studies have been not so much, as I say, in historical parallels, but in historical retrospect. And what I tried to write was really an essay in the liberal temperament, an essay about the origins of liberal rhetoric, an essay about the beginnings of the modern mind. When I say liberal, I don't mean, obviously, people who vote for Barack Obama or who vote for the Democratic Party. I don't mean liberal in that sense. I mean liberal in the much broader sense that takes in all of us who believe in a civilization rooted in procedure, rooted in election, rooted in a new kind of scientific understanding. I had the chance last night to speak to the American Philosophical Society, and I was reminded of how that society, truly more of a scientific society, natural philosophy in the 18th century sense, is rooted in profound ways with the birth of democracy in this country, with the birth of the new nation. One of my hosts said to me tonight, just as we were sitting in the green room, why didn't you choose Jefferson rather than Lincoln? And I was belligerently silent. Not so much because I was offended by the question, but because it was exactly something that I had been thinking about all day today. Being in Philadelphia, being in direct sight of Independence Hall, in direct sight of the monuments of that revolution, I was reminded that that liberal revolution, that first bursting forward of the ideas of the Enlightenment onto the political stage, though obviously part on and making a powerful contribution to the kind of history I was writing, that moment, those ideas of liberalism are very different from modern liberalism. They're very different from the point of view, the turn of mind that we all have. They are, on the whole, utterly optimistic. That is, the generation of the founders, Jefferson, the rest, believed in progress. They believed in scientific understanding. They believed in rationalism, and their optimism was only tinctured, not betrayed, by their knowledge of the tragedies of history. Our view of liberalism, our view of the world, is very different. We have lived through horrific wars. We have lived through enormous setbacks. We have some understanding, no matter how much we believe in a society of debate and democracy, we have some understanding of its costs, and we recognize that its costs are irrevocable and unrecoverable in many ways. We have, in short, a tragic consciousness, and that marriage of a tragic consciousness with a liberal outlook is one of the things that makes us modern, and it's one of the things that Lincoln and Darwin, as I'll try and outline a little bit tonight, shared, one of the things that they gave to us. Having been talking now for these months, what are the elements of that liberal rhetoric? What are the elements of the liberal temperament that Darwin and Lincoln shared, that they helped give to us, and particularly of the modern liberal temperament, the not just the Enlightenment liberal temperament, but the specifically modern liberal temperament? Can I condense them, distill them down into a few elements, leadership lessons from Darwin and Lincoln? I think I can. Let me try and do it, at least. Things that I think that they had in common that they passed on to us and that are part of our temperament, part of our way of organizing the world and speaking about it. The first thing, simple and profound, is the habit of arguing from down below, a habit of arguing from the bottom up. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, you see it very clearly in Darwin's case. If you read On the Origin of Species, that world-changing book that was published exactly 150 years ago today. Because as all of you know who have read it, and if you haven't read it, I urge you to do it. One of the points of this book is that not only is it a great book, but it's a great book. It's a wonderful read, and something that will give you enormous pleasure as you turn its pages. How does that book begin? This is a book where Darwin says at the very beginning, I am going to change your views about the very history of life. He says exactly, I think that I have an answer to what some have called the mystery of mysteries, the origin of species. And then he pauses and says, but before I go into that, let me tell you a little bit about what I've learned about what dog breeders and pigeon fanciers do. And he launches into a very long and very detailed explanation of how artificial selection works amongst dog breeders and pigeon fanciers. I don't mean he refers to it in a couple of paragraphs. I mean he has an exhaustive catalog explaining how it is that a pigeon fancier can take a big, fat pouter pigeon and turn it into a sleek messenger pigeon in a number of well-understood and limited generations. And he shows you how dogs, which we know, he understands, all derive from one wolf, one kind of wolf, can over limited numbers of generations by methods extremely well understood be transformed on the one hand into big barking dogs and on the other hand into tiny little yelping dogs. And we assent to it. It's so beautifully explained. And Darwin, I should add, this wasn't book learning on Darwin's part. He actually bred pigeons himself, and he went into London to talk to the pigeon fanciers of his time, who were almost all Cockneys, who were almost all working-class Londoners. They were the ones who had the expertise, and those were the ones that he tried to learn from. And similarly, he learned everything he could about the practice of dog breeding from dog breeders, so that he could lay out for you how simply this can be done by a process of artificial selection. So you've assented. You're halfway home before you know you're being argued at. And then he drops the trap. He says, we're all agreed that that can happen, right? That we can take a big gray wolf and turn it into a little yapping chihuahua. You say, yes, that can happen. You say, and we all agree that we can take one kind of rock pigeon, one kind of rock dove, and turn it into a strutting pigeon or a homing pigeon. We accept that, don't we? He said, yes, that's true. He says, well, why then, if we can do that over just a few generations with our paltry means, why couldn't that happen over the unimaginably long eons of time if nature is working on a similar process unintentionally and through a means that I can describe, that means of natural selection? The penny drops. The trap is sprung. You're engaged in the argument not on the basis of principles being exhorted from on high, but instead on the basis of practices being described from down below. It's a very, very powerful way of arguing, and it's completely disarming. In fact, so disarming was it that one of the first readers at John Murray, Darwin's publishing house, which was a commercial publishing house, by the way, said, all of the stuff in the beginning of this book about the dogs and the pigeons is absolutely fascinating and will make a very successful book. But the stuff that comes afterwards about the history of life and natural selection, that's all kind of dull. So why don't you ask the author to recast this so it'd be this wonderful book about dogs and pigeons? That's the way Darwin argues, and it's a revolutionary, a radically new way of arguing a case. And let's remember, he's arguing it for a popular audience. This is not an expert book published for an expert audience. It's a popular book published for people like you and me. It's published for everyone to read. It's one of the genuinely revolutionary cases in the history of thought where the expert book and the popular book are the same book. Think about the way Lincoln argues now, in exactly that same year, 1859, 1860. In spring of 1860, he comes to New York to give the address we now call the Cooper Union Address. And one of the great pleasures of this year is I actually got to stand in Cooper Union at Lincoln's podium on Lincoln's birthday and talk to a crowd of people. It was a frightening and stirring experience. Goes to Cooper Union, which is still intact. It's Great Hall, still there, in more or less the same shape as it was when Lincoln spoke, even if only lesser speakers speak there now. And he begins talking. Now, remember, the Cooper Union address, he's come east to New York, and this is his big chance. This is the moment when he is, and remember, Lincoln is an enormously ambitious man. If he's ever going to make a play for the presidency, this is the moment in early 1860 when he's going to have the chance to do it. There's good word about him from out west because of his debates with Stephen Douglas, but he's essentially unknown, one term as a congressman. So he has to impress this very hostile and skeptical New York crowd. And what does he start to do? He starts to talk about the signers of the Constitution and how they voted on issues of the national extension or prevention of slavery. I promise you it is one of the dullest things you have ever read or heard. It's so dull that I was actually in Chicago on the night of Lincoln's birthday. And my host, we had a kind of 2 hours on the radio with call-ins and so on. And my host, to try and liven up the evening a little bit, said, why don't we play Sam Waterston's recording of the Cooper Union address? And I sort of tightened inside because I knew what was coming, because you hear Sam Waterston with all of his histrionic ability saying, and then Elridge Kelly voted yay on the act of Fort. It's as exciting as hearing someone do your taxes. Lincoln goes through what every one of the 38 signers did one by one on that question. Well, why is he doing that? It seems like a wildly undramatic, a terribly non-melodramatic, a horribly anti-rhetorical way of beginning a crucial speech, a crucial political speech. Well, what he's doing is he's demonstrating that all of the signers of the Constitution of the United States, all of them without exception, voted, yay or nay, one way or the other, on questions having to do with the national extension of slavery. This is terribly important, because what does it show? It shows that all the men who wrote the Constitution believed that slavery was a national issue. They believed that it was a federal issue. And that the argument that the question of slavery, right or wrong, should be reserved to the states where slavery is still practiced was null. It was empty. And therefore, once you realize that someone sitting in New York or New Hampshire had just as much right constitutionally to speak to the question of slavery as anyone sitting in South Carolina or Virginia, then, Lincoln says, then we realize that this isn't a constitutional question of the disposition of powers. It's a moral question about the proposition of rights, about whether or not whether slavery is wrong and should be put, as he put it the year before, on a gradual course of extinction, or whether it's right and should be allowed to spread and grow. So the entire moral premise that Lincoln is trying to put forward isn't put forward as a premise. It's put forward as the conclusion at the end of a chain of narrow, evidence-based empirical argument. And it's no accident, and it's at the center of who Lincoln was, that he was a lawyer, and he had a legal turn of mind. In fact, when he finally did put through the Emancipation Proclamation, Karl Marx, who was following the war, his great critic from the left, said, this is the kind of petty summons that a provincial lawyer would send to another provincial lawyer. Lincoln doesn't argue from grand common principles to inspired conclusions. He argues as a lawyer will, from narrow evidence to irrefutable conclusions. I think you see there that that's a crucial part of what we might call the liberal temperament, the liberal turn of mind, the liberal frame. That is a belief that the evidence comes first, a belief in narrow empirical premises and broad intellectual conclusions. Now, of course, there's an element of disingenuousness, an element of coyness, an element of falseness in that. Lincoln's moral opposition to slavery was in many ways far more fundamental than his lawyerly reflections on the order of signing of the Constitution, just as Darwin's belief in his idea of natural selection was in place and perfected long before he started studying dogs and pigeons. But both understood that the way to make the argument to an audience was not through insistence, it was through the eloquence of slow and gradual and persuasive explanation. So that's one thing, arguing from the ground up. That's a crucial part of the liberal temperament that these two men shared and that they've passed on to us. Second thing is what I like to call the habit of sympathetic summary, or what's sometimes called by philosophers the practice of charity. And what do they mean by that? Well, they mean the insistence, the necessity of summing up what you're doing, of having a sympathetic view of what your critics have said, of what your opponents have said, while you criticize them, as you're beginning to criticize them. In other words, instead of treating your critics' arguments with sneers and contempt, you try to enter into those arguments as sympathetically as you can and only then begin to controvert them. Darwin does this spectacularly well, again, in On the Origin of Species. He not only anticipates the arguments that will be made against his theory, which are exactly the same arguments, I might add, that are made against it now. What's good would be the use of half an eye. How could you have something as complicated as a wing evolve in gradual steps? And he doesn't just say, there may be something in it, but I think you're wrong. He says, these questions have kept me up nights. These questions have worried me. They've prevented me from publishing. I recognize how powerful and persuasive these objections seem. But, and then he goes on to make the counter-argument. And that habit of summarizing your critics' arguments in its most powerful case, rather than in its weakest and most derisory case, that, it seems to me, is a crucial part, again, of the liberal temperament, and we see it in Darwin. With Lincoln, of course, we see it equally clearly in his capacity to extend his compassion and his understanding to the cause of the South, even as he engages in a horrible and bloody war to end their practice of slavery and their habit of secession. We see it, I think, most eloquently and most famously, most beautifully, in the second inaugural, where Lincoln says clearly, what's happening here, and it's very important, he invokes God, but he doesn't say God has been on our side because we're on the right side and everyone has had to suffer in that pursuit. He says instead, we don't really understand how a good God could have done something this terrible. He says, specifically, that one can only yield to the enigma of having this kind of God. That is, he says, God must have seen that slavery was evil, and he's brought on this great evil of a war to rectify it. And yet, how can we believe in a good and just God who's capable of imposing, capable of asserting this much suffering and this much bloodshed in any cause? And finally, he says, God's will is not our will. God's will is not our own. And we're both engaged, both sides are engaged in a historical struggle far more astounding, to use his wonderful word, than any of either of us could have anticipated. That habit of empathy, that practice of sympathetic summary, seems to me, again, something that Lincoln and Darwin share and something that they pass on to us as modern citizens. And finally, it seems to me that what Lincoln and Darwin share and what sets them apart from Jefferson and the generation of the Enlightenment, the generations of the founders of this country, is a tragic consciousness rooted in their knowledge of the fatality of the world. Both Lincoln and Darwin experience death close up, and then they experience it as a universal phenomenon. Both Lincoln and Darwin lose a favorite child. Darwin loses his daughter, Annie, when she's just 10 years old. He had 10 children, loved them all, but had a particular favorite, Annie, in whom he saw so much of himself. She was a little girl who liked to read dictionaries. He loses her, and with her, he loses the last vestiges of his faith, and he realizes that the process that he's seen in nature, what he calls the wedge of death, the way that extinction acts to weed out failed or unfit species, is in fact a wedge of enormous cruelty. The death and dying is the great shaper of animal life and ultimately of human life, and that there is no cease from it. There is no escape from it. That rule of fatality is the central rule of the history of life. Lincoln, too, loses his own favorite son, Willie, in the White House when he's just 11 years old. And we might think of Lincoln as being in some ways a hypocrite or a lesser man because, of course, countless boys had been losing their lives, too, directly because of his actions. And yet he's able to make the connection between his own loss of Willie and all of those other tens and hundreds of thousands of grieving parents whose grief he has in some ways, as he knows full well, helped to engineer and helped to cause. And he realizes that the faith he believes in, the faith in what we call liberalism, a belief in that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth, that belief can only be watered in blood, that belief will demand then on the battlefields of Gettysburg and Antietam, as later on the battlefields of the Second World War, or even at Hiroshima, that belief's justification will demand a great dying. That tragic consciousness is something that we share not just as liberal people, but as modern people. And it's something that I think begins in their time and that they both are exemplary instances of. I've been talking all year, and I've been talking a lot tonight, but before I stop, I hope you'll allow me just to read a little bit from my own writing, because I tried to conclude this book as best I could. And let me read you that conclusion now. Lincoln and Darwin both had profound knowledge of the common experience of death. Lincoln of death and war, Darwin of death as the great sword of existence. Yet when death touched their core experience, that knowledge was of absolutely no help or consolation. Charles wouldn't have grieved less for Annie or Mary for Willie, Mary, Lincoln's wife, if they had known more about the vulnerability of small children to tuberculosis and typhoid. That, again, is one central point of Darwinism. The habit of nature is regularity, but the rule of life is variation. No one had looked more grimly into the face of mass death than Abraham Lincoln, who grasped the awful arithmetic of modern war. But he could never detach himself from all that death or find health in apprehension of the aggregate when death touched his own core. Darwin knew better than anyone that the wedge of death was inexorable, cleaving the quick from the lifeless without purpose or plan. But his knowledge didn't ease his grief when Annie died. Masterly knowledge of the common experience brought no understanding or consolation. All the attentions of his adult life had been devoted to this subject, the propagation and blind culling, the winnowing of each species young on the threshing floor of death. No one understood this better than Charles Darwin. No one understood it at that time except Charles Darwin, and it made no difference at all. And yet, I go on, and yet, let me find the passage here. Darwin and Lincoln were makers and witnesses of the great change that, for good or ill, marks modern times. The slow emergence from a culture of faith and fear to one of observation and argument, and from belief in the judgment of divinity to a belief in the verdicts of history and time. For good or ill, this is what we mostly mean by modernity and by the special conditions of modern times. This emergence, of course, is seen by many as a terrible descent, the loss of the certainty of a single set of sure values. Yet their pain and problem is ours. Our beliefs about the world are still likely to be touched by either Lincoln's kind of agonized intuitive spirituality or by Darwin's calm domestic stoicism, his quiet doubt. They found a way throughout to sustain the necessary values of the Enlightenment in the face of pessimistic truths about the universe and political conduct. Darwin was a sort of stoic and Lincoln a suffering man, but neither was ever or merely resigned. Both gave liberalism a tragic consciousness without robbing it of a hopeful view. I sometimes like to think that this is a book about the liberal temperament and, in a broader sense, about liberal humanism. And let me end by a reflection on what we mean by humanism. I've talked of the Enlightenment, I've talked of liberalism, I've talked of modernity. And what ties us all together is a certain kind of humanism. It seems to me we can have two views of what humanism means. We can accept the Renaissance view that man is the measure of all things, but everything in our experience shows us that man is not the measure of all things, that we live in a world largely indifferent to his welfare and made and created in a time beyond his imagining. But we can have another view, what I think of as a modern view, and that is that all things can be measured by man, that what makes us distinct, what makes us significant, and what makes our actions important is that in this perplexing universe of suffering and death, we are capable of moments of understanding and of times of great eloquence. Lincoln and Darwin continue to move me as measurers as much as makers and as men of a quiet eloquence of understanding and explanation. Thank you so much for coming tonight.
Great. Okay. I know you all know how this works. Who would like to start us off right here in front?
Questions.
I just got a brochure from a museum in Kentucky, which is called the Creationism Museum. They have thousands of children come there every week and every year, with their parents, without, who tell them that the Bible is the way things happen, that this business about Darwin and the monkeys and all that other stuff is a bunch of nonsense. Now, if Darwin were here today, what would he say to these kids when they say, my mommy says this, my daddy says this, my minister tells me this, even in school they tell me this?
Let me tell you what Darwin would say. Let me read you what he wrote. In one moment. he said, Karl Marx's son-in-law wanted to dedicate a radically anti-religious book to Darwin. And one of the funny things about Darwinism in the 19th century is that people on the extreme left, like the Marx family, loved Darwin and Darwinism. People on the extreme right, like his cousin Francis Dalton, loved Darwin and Darwinism. And Darwin was caught somewhere in the liberal middle. Anyway, he wrote to Karl Marx's son-in-law, I am a strong advocate for free thought on all subjects, yet it appears to me, whether rightly or wrongly, that direct arguments against Christianity and theism generally produce hardly any effect on the public, and that freedom of thought is best promoted by the gradual illumination of men's minds, which follows from the advance of science. It has therefore been always my object to avoid writing anything on religion, and I have confined myself to science. I may, however, have been unduly biased by the pain which it would give some members of my family if I aided in any way direct attacks on religion. He's talking there about his wife, Emma, who lived and died as a believer. I think what Darwin would have said back was he would have wanted to avoid the controversy because he believed that the spread of ideas and the spread of science did its own kind of work, that polemics about faith did much less positive work for the world and for his own beliefs than simply the spread of his own ideas, which he always went to great trouble to make, as I've said tonight, as simple and persuasive, as lucid as he possibly could. I share that belief. And it's one of the things we were talking before about Richard Dawkins, I know, visited not long ago, and I'm a keen admirer of Dawkins's writing and of much of Dawkins' work, but I find something jarring or grating about a great deal of his writing on religion, exactly because it strikes me as have a note of insecurity, which is un-Darwinian. Darwin believed, as I think that passage suggests, that a man of science should have a certain serenity about the spread of his ideas. And I think if we look at history whole, instead of, I was just in Kentucky, by the way, and out there, instead of looking at little pockets of resistance, we look at the real story of Darwinism, which is how this very radical, very demanding, and very difficult idea went from one tiny desk in a house in the countryside of England to become something understood by millions of people, and particularly by a huge community of scientists all over the world. I tend to share Darwin's optimism about the power of scientific reasoning alone to do the work it needs to do. Someone else? Here in the middle? Gentleman here? No, just speak up and I'll repeat it if people can't hear you. Cynical opportunism was the secret. I realized that my publisher pointed out to me that the 200th anniversary of both men was coming up and that I had written on both of them, so why not put them together and make a buck for him and me both? That's close to the truth, but not truly the truth. The truth is that I have always been a great admirer of Darwin's prose. Darwin is a writer, and I felt I had something new to say about Darwin as a writer rather than Darwin as a scientist. Science is not something I'm expert to comment on, but the writing I felt I could. So I started writing that, and then I stumbled onto the debate, which gives this book its title, Angels and Ages, about what the final words were that were said over Lincoln's body by Edwin Stanton, his Secretary of War. Did Stanton say now he belongs to the angels or now he belongs to the ages? And since that little quarrel summed up in such a wonderful epigrammatic way the whole religious, scientific debate, do we all belong to history or to heaven, that I was drawn into that debate, which, of course, is a debate about language as well. So I realized that I was, over a space of 6 months and two essays, I was struggling with the question of what an academic would call the origins of liberal rhetoric in the modern age. I couldn't use that as a subtitle. Source of it. And then I stumbled on the bizarre coincidence that they were born on the same day, and I thought I saw a graceful way to bring these two studies of mind and language together. But my editor was pleased when he found out that we could do it for them. A gentleman here.
Thank you for your brilliant summary of the connection of these two men, and that the level of consciousness that they sort of brought into the world from that time in 1809, you know, to later in the century. I'm wondering what you see today the potential for another level of increase in awareness or consciousness, and where that might be going from where we are today.
Well, you know, one of the interesting questions I've got out on this long road that I've been speaking on is, who would you choose now? Who will people be writing about 100 years, 200 years from now as having a similar effect on their minds, having helped to form their minds, who are alive today? And I don't really have a good answer for it. I've tried to come up with some answers, and you can make sort of stabs at Einstein or whomever you choose, but it's hard to know. I think that's because, as I've meditated on that oddity, I think it's because in many respects we're still living in their time. I don't mean specifically in the time of Lincoln and Darwin, though it's certainly the case that evolutionary biology, Darwinism as an explanatory model, has never been more powerful, never been more persuasive to more people, for good or ill, than it is now. And it's also certainly true that since the revolutions of 1989, that liberalism, liberal democracy in Lincoln's sense, has never seemed more attractive, more seductive, to have the wind of history at its back. So we're living in their time in lots of ways. That's what we are. We're modern people living in a liberal civilization who have to reconcile every day their shared consciousness of the absolute tragedy and fatality of life with their optimism about the possibility of understanding the world. So in some ways, I think we're still in that orbit, just as they were still very much in the orbit of the Enlightenment, and we'll only know what next orbit we're in at some time rather far from now. So all the way in the back here. What did Charles think of Abe? What did Abe think of Charles? Abe was, so far as we know, unaware of Charles. Origin of Species is published in 1859, and Lincoln has other things to think about soon after. But, and you can see a copy of this book, there's a book called The Vestiges of Creation, which is written anonymously, but actually by a Scottish publisher named Robert Chambers in the 1840s. And this book, which is a proto-evolutionary text, had an enormous influence on Lincoln. Herndon, Lincoln's partner, said it was the book that was responsible for making Lincoln into a free thinker, into an atheist. It's one of the things that our history teachers hush up a little bit. But Lincoln out on the frontier was famous, annoyingly famous, for arguing against religion. And when he ran for office for the first time, he had to write a kind of public apology saying it was true that he had been arguing against religion, but he didn't mean your religion or your religion. He meant just sort of religion, somebody else's religion was what he was arguing against. So Lincoln was certainly powerfully affected by evolutionary ideas, which affected Darwin, but which he had contempt for because he thought they weren't scientific. Darwin, on the other hand, was crucially aware of Lincoln. This is a very important point. Darwin was a passionate abolitionist. If there was one kind of core conviction that governed Darwin throughout his life, it was a hatred of slavery. And there's a case to be made that even his openness to an idea of evolution, which wasn't entirely new, had to do with his sense that the family of man was one and that slavery was kind of an act of pedophilia, an act of an assault on the common family of man. So he saw the struggle in America as being absolutely essential, both because slavery had to end, but also because, as he wrote to an American friend, what happens in America will crucially determine what happens in Europe. If the North, if the Union loses the Civil War, he wrote, then the cause of democratic reform will be set back for generations in England and in Europe. That's one side of the American Civil War that it's very helpful to live in Europe for a while to understand, because it's not something, we're too insular to understand this. The American Civil War had a huge impact abroad. In some odd ways, you could almost argue greater than it did here, where Reconstruction intervenes and the old order is in many ways reinstalled in the South. That is, for French Republicans and for British radicals, for British Democrats, that the North's triumph was an act of enormous vindication, and it's one of the things that helps lead to the Reform Act in Britain after the war. And one of the bravest things that happened in the whole history of the war happened in the north of England, where the mill workers refused to process southern cotton because of their convictions against slavery, even though they put themselves out of work doing it. It's one of the great kind of untold battles of the American Civil War, and it took place in the north of England. Gentlemen here.
For a minute. It is generally considered the turning point in Lincoln's political career. But yet, when you read it, as you point out, or listen to it, it doesn't ring such an important, it doesn't sound that way. What, in your view, has in that speech caused it to become where drama started following?
Right. Everyone knows what we're referring to. In early 1860, he goes to New York, as I said earlier this evening, gives this speech at the Great Hall of Cooper Union. It lights up the whole of the Eastern United States and makes him a plausible candidate for president. My friend Harold Holzer, a wonderful amateur historian, argues it's a speech that made Lincoln president. And as you say, as this gentleman is saying, as I said earlier, when you read it, you say, huh? I don't get it. What was so important about this speech? What was important about it was what I was trying to characterize before. That is, it took the constitutional argument seriously. And it said to everybody who was kind of scratching their head saying, I believe that slavery is wrong, but I suppose that as constitutionalists, as good Americans, we have to accept its continuation because we can't, or and even its spread, because there's no constitutional protection against it. And Lincoln's point was, you don't have to accept that. That's a fallacious argument. You don't have to believe it. You have as much right to determine the fate of a slave in Kansas or the spread of slavery as anyone else. He danced a very fine line about abolishing slavery in the South at that point. He said unequivocally and explicitly, slavery, those of us who oppose it, believe it should be put on the course to its gradual and certain extinction. I think those are his words. So he said that, but he also backed, it's a very long and complicated story. But I think that what people needed at that time was to believe that there not only were powerful moral arguments against slavery, which the abolitionists, of course, had been uttering for decades, but that there was a powerful constitutional argument that being anti-slavery and being a strict constitutionalist were possible. I think, in a nutshell, that's what Lincoln accomplished with that speech. He gave legal arguments to moral feelings. Maybe that's a good way of putting it. Lady here. Well, why do, if you didn't hear the question, why, what is, what's peculiar about Americans that makes them believe, us believe in creationism rather than in, this moments like this, I claim my Canadian identity. that makes you believe in creationism. I drop my Phillies cap, put on my Expos cap, and claim it. Why? It's a complicated question, difficult question. Two things should be said. One is, it's not clear always when you ask those questions what is meant. Evolution itself, Darwinian theory, evolutionary theory, is a very hard thing to understand in its details. It's easy to get the big picture. So most people don't actually know what the theory claims. They have a vague idea. So it's a sort of broader educational problem in lots of ways. We were talking about this last night. More broadly, we live in a believing society. We live in a society, unlike most of the societies of Europe, for instance, where religious faith is still a very, very powerful part of the identity of enormous numbers of people. I don't see that as a bad thing. I mean, I don't see that as a negative thing. It's a fact to be respected. I don't think there is any scarcity of powerful and persuasive arguments that reconcile religious belief with Darwinian evolution. There are arguments. Well, you know, I'll give you a quick one because not many people know it. When one of the first books, copies of The Origin of Species that Darwin sent out, was to Queen Victoria's chaplain, a very weird man named Charles Kingsley. It was weird because he was a great children's book writer, and he had a whole theory of how sex begins in defecation, which I won't even go into tonight. But he was a strange and interesting man. If you wait, come later, and I'll tell you what Kingsley's theory was. Anyway, Kingsley said, religious man, Queen Victoria's chaplain, when he received the book, he said, Darwin is the Newton of biology. Because just as Newton was able to open the mind of God to us and to let us see that what looks like the haphazard passage of the planets, in fact, corresponds to a very simple and elegant universal scheme, in the same way, Darwin is able to show us that what looks like the haphazard abundance and proliferation of biological forms on the earth, in fact, follows a simple and elegant rule, simple and elegant law. There's one of many reconciliations that you could make. In other words, you could say, what a sloppy God a God would be who raced around constantly reinventing the wheel and putting things that look just like it, and what a masterly God a God would be who said, I'm going to drop one little protozoa in this planet and then leave it to simmer like a slow-cooking cook, and everything else will flow from it. So I think that the answer is that we don't have to regard that as a threat to Darwinism, but we have to regard it as a challenge to education, to teach and to educate. Lady here.
This is a really important question that I wanted to answer to for a long time. Did Olivia ever get to?
Thank you for asking that. The lady is moving on from trivia to substantial matters and asking me if my daughter Olivia, who when she was 3 and 4 had an imaginary friend named Charlie Ravioli, who I wrote about at length, And Charlie Ravioli's significant feature was that he was always too busy to play with her. Olivia was growing up in New York, and that was the world she had around her, and she would put her little play cell phone up to her ear, and she'd say, "Hello, Ravioli, Ravioli? Okay. Okay, call me later." And she would, and then she would turn to us and say, "I always get his machine." That's a true story. And I built a whole story about Olivia and about the busyness of New York out of that, and I'm glad you remember it because it's one I like. Olivia outgrew Ravioli, and Ravioli now is on the shelf where the other things that she's 3 and 4, and she gets a little uneasy when people ask her about him because she outgrew her imaginary friend. But he's become a famous imaginary friend, so I said to her, you know, you should copyright him, and you know, and sell him. But she's moved on beautifully. But Ravioli remains for us, for her parents, a very powerful shorthand symbol of the crazy busyness of New York life. When we've had one of those days, you can't believe it, just say, how was your day? I was bumping into Charlie Ravioli all day. And that, and it lasts in that way. Gentlemen here, and then I'll come. The question of the Emancipation Proclamation and Lincoln's reasons for doing it and so on are very complex. I was up at a conference at Harvard in February where this was bruited about. Hair was pulled, punches were thrown, rhetorical hair and rhetorical punches. But it's a very complicated subject. Let me try and give you my own, perhaps overly Lincoln-idolizing read of it. Two things are important to understand. One is Lincoln didn't know if he had any statutory authority to abolish slavery by a proclamation in the loyal states, because they still had functioning legislatures. The theory of the Emancipation Proclamation was that by seceding, by violating the Constitution, the legislatures of the southern states were now null and void, and that law in the South could be made by proclamation on the part of the president. Therefore, he had the right to abolish slavery in the South, which was in a condition of rebellion, and he didn't have the right to abolish slavery in the northern states, where only the state legislatures could do it. That's one slightly lawyerly and kind of, you know, slightly fine print version, but it was an important consideration. More than that, of course, he knew that it would be politically dangerous to the northern cause to over-alienate the people in the border states. Most of all, I think, remember, with Lincoln generally, I think two things are true. One is that his abhorrence of slavery was profound and deep and deeply felt. And the other thing is that in the best possible sense, in the sense that I find wholly admirable and to be very much part of the liberal temperament that I've been trying to describe tonight, he was a politician. He was a Democratic politician. And he was a politician working for good ends within the fabric of the possible. And that was the most possible thing he could do at that moment. And if you want a kind of pro-Lincoln account of the whole transaction, I urge you to read John Stauffer's book, which just published this year, called Giants. It's about Lincoln's relationship with Frederick Douglass, the great African-American leader of abolitionism, and how these two men, Douglass at first was very skeptical of Lincoln's motives and of Lincoln's policies, but over the course of the war, they grew together. And Lincoln, in fact, called Douglass in before he issued the Emancipation Proclamation, had him read it, and said, "What do you think? Is this a positive move or is this a negative move?" Because Lincoln was well aware of its limits. And Douglass said, no, it's a very positive move. It's the right thing to do, even though it's imperfect, even though it's not entirely complete. And it's one of the most moving moments for me in all of American history is that, after the second inaugural, Lincoln has Douglass to the White House. He invites him to the White House, and in full view of the cabinet and everyone else, he steps forward and shakes his hand and says, "Here is my friend." So I think that, you know, we talk in sentimental ways sometimes about moral growth, people who grow in office. Almost no one ever does. It doesn't happen that way. But Lincoln really did. Lincoln, through the course of the war, it was a kind of course in moral purification for him. And there's no more powerful and passionate witness to it than Frederick Douglass. I urge everyone to read that remarkable book. It's called Giants by John Stauffer. He's a professor at Harvard. Yes, gentlemen, here. It's a very profound question. I worry that we have. I think sometimes, for instance, this will seem like a strange connection, but it's one that's been haunting me. I've been working on a piece about JFK for the last while. You know, next year will be the 50th anniversary of, it's hard to believe for anyone who remembers him, will be the 50th anniversary of John Kennedy's campaign for president. And one of the things that's very impressive about JFK is that he had, though he was a playboy and a philanderer and had many, a lot of dubious character traits. He had that tragic consciousness strongly, and he had it because of his experience in the war, which was made to seem heroic by his father, the PT-109 incident, but which Kennedy knew himself was much more absurd than it was heroic. His little tiny ship got run over by a Japanese destroyer, and all his men were thrown out into the sea. And it was much more an existential than a heroic experience for Kennedy. He realized how fragile life is, how quickly people die, and he realized the enormous waste of war. More than anything else, he realized the enormous waste of war. And throughout his life, and most particularly a moment I remember from my Philadelphia childhood, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the absolute urgency of not succumbing to war. Remember, all of his chiefs of staff wanted him to bomb Cuba, which we now know would have resulted in a nuclear exchange. Because the Russians in Cuba had nuclear weapons that they had orders to fire. Kennedy kept in the forefront of his mind the waste of war, as Lincoln would have done. He understood, he had that tragic sense of the meaningless fatality of life, which should make us prize it all the more. If there's one thing that we should admire about JFK, I think it is that. And I think that's the single most impressive thing about him, which is only to say that tragic consciousness appears sporadically, occasionally. You don't see it, and it's one of the reasons I think we should all be a little queasy, a little dubious about the kind of greatest generation nostalgia for the glories of the Second World War. It wasn't really like that. It may have been necessary, as Lincoln's war was necessary, but it wasn't beautiful, and it wasn't inspiring. And I think that when we see that kind of tragic consciousness springing up in the form of the urgent rejection of death and the urgent rejection of the facile solution of war, then I think that Lincoln and Darwin's tradition is very much alive. Time for two more questions, so let me turn to this lady here. I deliberately kept Obama's name out of this book, though I was writing it during his ascension. The question was Obama in Afghanistan, Obama more generally, does he have some sense of the cost of war and a tragic consciousness and so on? I left his name out of the book, though he was rising to power in that extraordinary way as I was writing it, and though inevitably I saw, when you talk about the eloquence of explanation, you can't help but think of Barack Obama. Nonetheless, I wanted to put that completely to one side. The honest, banal, fatuous, inexcusable answer is too soon to tell, too soon to say. We're beginning to understand where he is and what the consequences of what he do will be. Remember, one of the reasons we admire Lincoln so much is because he was vindicated by history. He won, in plain English, and there were lots of moments when he could not have, came very near to doing that. I don't mean to be indifferent to that, but those are the contingencies of history and the chances of fate. And we don't know where Obama is. I am an enormous admirer of his, but I would certainly not bracket him with Lincoln quite yet. And gentlemen here, and then we have to stop. Oh, what a good question. Did anyone hear it? What would the world have been like had Lincoln not been assassinated that night at Ford's Theater, had his bodyguard done his job, and prevented John Wilkes Booth from entering. Although, once again, it's only in retrospect we can see how insane that was. John Wilkes Booth was the Ben Affleck of his time. It was sort of like Matt Damon or Ben Affleck going up to Obama's box and saying, I'd like to see the president. It would take a very alert man to say, that might not be such a good idea. So what would have happened? It's a question I actually look at in the book a little bit. You know, there's a wonderful story that I think of when I think of it. Again, it has to do with JFK. Kennedy, excuse me, was a great admirer of Nehru, first Prime Minister of India. He thought he was one of the great men of his time, and he had met him early on in the 50s. He had met Nehru and been enormously impressed by him. Nehru was sort of anti-American, but he was a passionate and rational nationalist. Kennedy thought very highly of him. But he saw him again in, I believe, 1962, and he said to John Kenneth Galbraith, it was so disappointing. Nehru had become such a narrow, insular, provincial man compared to the man I met and the man I dreamed of. And then Kennedy said to Galbraith, he said, you know, that's what Lincoln would have been like had he lived. meaning that as the frustrations, as the difficulties, as the his own inability to fundamentally alter the path of Reconstruction grew, everything that was melancholy, noble, dignified, and tragic in Lincoln would have become increasingly narrow, parched, provincial in that way. I tend to think that what Lincoln would have been up against in Reconstruction would have been the same things that his successors were up against. And his own appetite for reconciliation would have been so strong that it would have been difficult for him to craft a history significantly different from the history that happened. Can I thank you all for coming tonight? And I'll sign some books. Thank you. And if you have residual questions, come out to the table and I'll be glad to answer them. Great. I went too long. I know I...
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.